Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot to share. We're going to look at health and nutrition in a powder that you can put on your teeth, or gel, I should say, that's really beneficial for your gums also, Science Daily, published in General Dentistry. Never thought this would happen. Chemicals found in your fruit and vegetables protect you from dementia, including Alzheimer's disease. And this is big time because this is mainstream science saying something that many of you have been practicing for your entire adult life, and that is making conscious choices to get more fruits and vegetables. Now they're saying, yes, you were doing the right thing. And this was before the British Pharmacological Society's major meeting. We also have that they're finding health and healing through ginger. Well, that's good, because ginger is one of those magical foods. And for those of you who lack joy, not so good. You're going to die sooner, and probably not an easy death. So just remember, your attitude does kill you. My guest in the second part of our program, and I'm going to give extra time to this guest today. We'll be speaking with him from Israel, Anthony Lowenstein. We're going to talk about disaster capitalism. We're going to see how a disaster is extremely good for business. And I'm going to mention, of course, Libya, because when you think of it for a moment, on one hand, we say that Libya was, and it's true, the number one country of all 54 countries in Africa. It was number one in education, number one in income savings, in household income, in no debt, in large amounts of capital, 124 tons of gold. That's a lot of gold. And plus, they had the largest largest man-made aquifer river system in the world, a huge complex that would have served tens of millions of people with water that do not have water. They had more freedom for women than any other country in the Middle East, including Israel. They had a better democracy than any other place I know of, including the United States. And yet you were told none of this. And so when they destroyed it, people said, why? Because of the oil? Because of stealing their gold? Why? Did you ever think that maybe it's because of the hundreds of billions of dollars made in rebuilding that, rebuilding Iraq, rebuilding Afghanistan? Yes, there's money made off the natural resources. But how much more is made when you can go in there and take the resources and use that as leverage and collateral for these thousands of companies to come in and charge outrageous amounts of money? I mean, they can charge you anything they want. And who are these people to argue? They say, well, we need a highway. Well, normally that highway would cost $1 million a mile, but we're going to only charge you $100 million a mile. Everyone's happy. Not so much. But I'm saving one topic today because we have a lot of people from Haiti listening to this program every day. In fact, right now as I'm speaking, and I'm not in New York, I'm finishing up on the road, a lot of cab drivers have this radio program on. They're from Haiti. We have activist groups that I work with from Haiti. In fact, last year, when the Haitians were protesting in front of Bill Clinton's offices in Harlem, they invited all the media. They invited people from BAI. Not a single person showed up, including from BAI. I did, because I support the Haitian movement to take back their country from the corrupt politicians, all of them, from the corrupt presidents, all of them, from all the corrupt GMOs, all of them. Am I missing anyone here? Think that's an exaggeration? Well, have you been to Haiti? Have you spent time there? Have you spent time staying with the local inhabitants? Do you have any idea, except what the news media feeds you, of what it's like to be there? Well, Anthony Lowenstein is an expert on it. And what role have the Clintons played in profiting her as Secretary of State? He threw his foundation in all those trips. Today you're going to hear that in depth. Plus, everywhere else that we can start a war and then have the profiteers come in right behind it. What role did then they play in lobbying for war? We'll deal with that as well. Also today, it's rare when a mainstream publication, Psychology Today, very respected, begins to allow, or has, I should say, for a while, dissenting voices. One of those today, Dr. Robert Berezin, MD, psychiatrist, board certified. The problem with contemporary psychiatric diagnosis, the destructive and damaging fiction of biological diseases. Wow. And I didn't even know he existed. Well, you can bet I'm going to be on the phone with him later today because I'm just wrapping up a major film. It's been almost 9 years of researching and filming to put this all together, called Manufacturing Madness. I'm challenging that the entire, I make no exceptions, the entire field of psychiatry today is a fraud. Everything connected with it is enabling that fraud, unless you're a psychiatrist like he, and then I'll explain the difference between the legitimate psychiatrists and those for hire by the pharmaceutical industry. But he's saying this, not me, so that's interesting. And then people have missed the whole point of this Panama uncovering of 11 million documents of all those secret bank accounts. Bernie Sanders got it right in 2011 when he testified as being on that banking committee or the Commerce Committee against this trade agreement. Who was for it? Hillary Clinton. So what did he say? And then I'll explain the two things that the media hasn't told you that's most important. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Some good information is published in Science Daily. The aloe vera plant, as we know, has a long history of healing power. Its ability to heal burns and cuts and soothe pain, that's well documented. That goes clear back to the 10th century. There are over 5,000 articles on the healing power of the mucopolysaccharides. Those are the healing ingredients in aloe. In fact, Cleopatra used aloe vera on her skin. And the modern use of aloe vera was first recognized in the 1930s to heal radiation burns. And since then, it's been a common ingredient in ointments for sunburn. In fact, I remember being in the tropics. I was filming, and I had not paid attention to something, and this was a lesson I had to learn, that even when you're not in the direct sunlight, the light is bouncing off trees, shrubs, and the ground and hitting you in the face. And I had a hat on, but at the end of the day, my face was beet red. And I'm thinking, wow. So I do what I would normally do, take massive amounts of certain nutrients, and that helped. But then the chef at this place I was staying came over. He recognized me. He says, he actually had the cookbook, one of my cookbooks. And he said, I got something for that. And he went in and he brought out a bucket. And the bucket was ice cold. He had ice in the bottom, but it had all this aloe vera gel. And then he had coconut gel. And he said, first you drink the coconut water, then you put this your face in that cold bucket of aloe vera gel for about 5 minutes, and then you put the coconut gel from immature coconuts on. I'd never heard that. I'd heard coconut gel, but rarely do you ever get an immature coconut. You get them when they're already white and solidified of the coconut meat or the coconut water, but not the gel. The gel comes when they're green. And so I did both. Within 1 hour, all red was gone. No pain, no blistering, nothing. So I thanked him and then took a whole backpack of the immature coconut So if it happened again or happened on my arms or wherever, I could have that. So that's just something for those of you who ever have some sunburn inadvertently and you want a different type of way of approaching it, because that's really going to help. Again, you're talking about aloe vera gel, cold, and then the coconut gel, fresh, on your burned skin. In any case, in this scientific study published in General Dentistry by the Academy of General Dentistry, peer-reviewed journal, they found that aloe vera is great for your teeth and your gums, not just your skin. It does a whole lot of good and at the pathological level with the oral microflora. What we have to understand is in our mouth, we have disease-causing bacteria. And overnight, they really multiply. And that's why a lot of people have that, you know, morning breath or foul-smelling breath. The ability of aloe vera gel to successfully perform that function of killing that is now proven. It has great germ-fighting ability in the gut, in the stomach. Yes, especially if you have Helicobacter, E. pylori, but also in your mouth as well. So, and why? Because they found it contains what are called anthraquinones, which are chemical compounds that are used in healing and arresting pain. They're anti-inflammatory. So to the dentist listening, and we know some dentists listen, Dr. Elmira Goodall listens and others, has it on their office, you might want to consider getting a aloe vera gel to massage with a light amount of clove on the gums of people who've had oral surgery or who are sensitive to pain, and that will help them. Something new, something different, something we didn't know before, now we do. This is really important for people who have brain conditions, and we have tens of millions of people with brain conditions. In fact, there is not a day that passes that I don't hear from someone saying, my mom, my dad, my brother, someone has got dementia, what do we do? And of course, one of the most challenging things when a person has dementia before Alzheimer's is that because they're forgetting, they don't remember what they have been told. So they forget that they have heard something. So they, you didn't tell me that. No, I did. 10 minutes ago, I said it. No, you didn't. That's how it is. And you'll have that conversation all day long. So what can we do to help? Well, according to this study from the British Pharmacological Society in Edinburgh, Dr. Robert Wilson put forth the evidence that certain flavonoids, those are the chemicals found in plants and foods derived from plants, has therapeutic benefit for Alzheimer's sufferers. Quote, there has been some intriguing epidemiological studies that the consumption of flavonoid-rich vegetables and fruits and juices and red wine delays the onset of the disease. By the way, he's the top biochemist at King's College London. And then he goes on to talk about how it's very encouraging what they have seen. Now, when you look at the actual scientific evidence, you're looking at antioxidants, including vitamin E and vitamin C. Those are all good. But if you really want to help the brain, you're going to have coenzyme Q10, acetyl-L-carnitine, glycerol phosphorylcholine. You're going to have black cumin seed oil. You're going to have everything that turns off inflammation in the brain and an alkalizing diet. Starting your day with the juice of 2 lemons, 1 teaspoon of apple cider vinegar, diluted that, and ideally, if you can do it ideally, 16 ounces of green apple with a pinch of ginger, and you drink that down every morning before you do anything. That will help alkalize your body, turn off pain in your joints. That's like giving the inside of your body a healing shower. It really stimulates detoxification and detoxification enzymes in the liver. It's great for you. That's before you do anything. You want to make sure that the epicatechin, E-P-I-C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N, epicatechin, which is a flavonoid, that you get that. You're getting that, which helps on your cellular level when you're having your fruits. So the berries, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, strawberries, pomegranate, cherries, mangosteen. Those are what contain that. You want your vegetables as well. Remember, the green vegetables help detoxify and cleanse. The red fruits help to rejuvenate and revitalize the DNA. And so that's what helps you with your brain. You just have to do it in larger amounts than what they're doing it in this particular study. I would have used probably five times the quantity they used, but they still got good results. And also, we mentioned ginger. Ginger is just one of those wonderful, wonderful plants. If you grow it, it can get about 15 feet high, has a beautiful flower that comes out, a white flower, but it's the root of it that is really where all the medicinal value is. And it's aromatic, especially at night. So if you interplant around your house ginger, jasmine, lilac, lavender, honeysuckle, and then you leave your window open, all that aromatherapy wafts right into the room and you're smelling it. It is magical. I have that around my house. I grow all those. I go for a walk and you smell that and you're just transposed to a different place. But it also, there's pheromones that impact the brain, and any of those really wonderful aromatic smells calm you and help heal. So it's great for healing people from different illnesses to put, maybe by their bedside, put a potpourri of those wonderful smells. And you shake it every time you come in the room, or once a day, you just shake it, and that releases more of the oils, because otherwise they're dried. And a good potpourri, you put it in the closet, it'll last about a month. But this way, someone who's sick is recovering with something wonderful like that. Also, something as simple as a goldfish in an aquarium or a bowl. Watching that relaxes someone and enhances their recovery. Simple little things can make a difference. Now, I would suggest also absolutely having dogs and cats, but sometimes people are in a condition where they can't have a dog or a cat or standards or saliva on them. But for things that they're not going to personally come into contact with, aromatherapy is a great way of healing. Well, they did this study on ginger, and they found that it helps not just with nausea and diarrhea, but it helps turn off inflammation anywhere in the body. It helps your heart. It helps with arthritis, it helps with colic, and it helps with headaches. Yeah, we knew it was great for on long trips or boat rides or airplanes if you had nausea. And that's because the rhizome, R-H-I-Z-O-M-E, is filled with healing, use ginger, and this study was done at the University of Michigan's Comprehensive Cancer Center. Because I definitely recommend ginger every day as a juice. One inch juiced and put that into a larger juice of that you're diluting potent one along with wheatgrass and garlic and spirulina and chlorella and coconut oil for helping people with every kind of cancer. Plays a great role. And just look at the chemicals in there, what are called gingerols. Ginger, G-I-N-G-E-R, alls, O-L-S, and Shogaols, S-H-O-G-A-O-L-S. And why do I spell things all the time? Because people around the world who may not be, or may not have English as a first language, sometimes they have to write stuff down, so I just want them to have that information. And finally, this is from Tohoku University Graduate School of Medicine in Sendai. It says, people who don't think life is worth living are more likely to die within the next few years. They mainly die of cardiovascular disease. And this was a study of 43,000 men and women. And they found that if you don't find exciting ways of bringing things into each day, then you're not connecting. And there was a Dutch professor on this study at Rotterdam's Erasmus University, who said, quote, happiness does not heal, but happiness protects against falling ill. I disagree. I agree that he is half right. Happiness protects against falling ill. But I have seen too many times where happiness does help people heal. So if you lack joy in your life, give yourself a break to have joy. Find things. Get a support team that where you all find joy in something important. You'll live a longer life. That's the latest on health and healing. Now I want to go to this. This is from Psychology Today, the current issue. This is from a Dr. Robert Berezin, B-E-R-E-Z-I-N, a medical doctor, board certified in psychiatry. And it's a long article. First of all, I commend Psychology Today because I have read over the last many years dozens of articles of psychologists and psychiatrists speaking out about what is wrong with the current medical psychological model and more humanistic, holistic ways of helping people. So to those who are following a more humanistic model, and there are many, Henry Grayson and so many others, I commend you for that. For those who are doing it only as somatic medicine, please look at what you're doing and ask yourself a simple question. And I once asked this. I had a lot of friends who were psychiatrists. Elaine Kahn was one of the brightest. She's passed last year, but she was one of the brightest psychologists and humanists I've ever met. We were close friends for 35 years and wrote a book together and worked at a center together, helping people. Alan Putterman, Carmi Harari, there was a whole group, Albert Ellis, Donald Mullins, Lloyd Glauberman, lots of people, some alive, most past, but these were humanistic people. And I asked one day when there was a whole group of people together and we were having dinner, and I asked a simple question. How do you know that you're helping your patients? By what standard do you measure the success of a therapy? It's a reasonable question. And there's this long pause. And normally everyone who was very personable and outspoken would all jump in. But I didn't see that. And I said, at what point do you realize that you're using the patient as your next mortgage payment? At what point do you realize that you've done the best you can, but maybe that's not what they need? And you realize that maybe you're a part of the problem. And have you examined that? Now, there was no definitive answer, but it stimulated an interesting discussion. And that leads me to this. Quote, life is pain, princess. Anyone who tells you different is selling you something. That was from Dread Pirate Roberts in The Princess Bride. Great film, if you've never seen it, by the way. Everywhere you turn, you see OCD, ASD, MDD, ADD, ADHD, BPD, GAD, PD, SAD, PTSD, MPD, etc. The problem is not limited to this acronym soup, but the pseudo-diagnosis they represent. Patients today get stained by the specious medical diagnosis of biological psychiatry. And furthermore, they are brainwashed to believe that these fictitious brain diseases are genetic. Biological psychiatry treats people like they are mechanical objects, renaming them almost as they were rebranding products. The one I like the best is the renaming of manic depression to bipolar. Instead of a name which accurately describes the states of suffering, it has turned into something mechanical, a battery of two poles, where we've gone from something human to something Frankensteinian. But fear not, we have psychoactive drugs that will correct the imbalance in your genetically damaged brain. We have antidepressants for your depression. We have benzodiazepines for your anxiety, amphetamines for your ADHD, antipsychotics for schizophrenia, antidepressants for your OCD, etc. Sadly, I've heard many stories from patients that began when they received their diagnosis. They are told they have a disease. Quote, it's not your fault. It's genetic. For the lucky few, it may take only a few years to discover their biological diagnosis is bogus. Then they find their way to a good therapy and or continue on their journey. We are sold a bill of goods where it is believed that taking drugs could possibly attend to the incredible complexity of human suffering. How did it happen that within a generation such a delusion captured the public imagination and currently holds sway? Young people have said to me, "You're a psychiatrist, and you do psychotherapy? I never heard of that." Initially, I was shocked. Now I get letters all the time from people who ask me if I know any psychiatrists in their own town who don't give drugs. There have always been two competing currents in psychiatry. Psychodynamic, which I support personally, by the way, fundamentally it's psychoanalytic psychotherapy, versus somatic psychiatry that I'm absolutely adamantly opposed to, as you will see from this new documentary on manufacturing madness. Now there's only one. For the story of somatic psychiatry, you can read Do No Harm, The Destructive History of Pharmaceutical Psychiatry and Its Bedfellows, Electroshock, Insulin Shock, and Lobotomies. This gives the true story of somatic psychiatry. Its practice has been to act directly on our brains, shock them, reaming them out with ice picks. It used to be called the ice pick operation because they'd jam an ice pick up your nose or something that resembled an ice pick, and then rubbing it around, destroying the frontal lobe of your brain. That was the lobotomy. And now reaming them out chemically. Somatic psychiatry has also done great harm, but its sordid history has gotten lost in the amnesia of time. But make no mistake, pharmaceutical psychiatry is the current incarnation of somatic psychiatry, and we are doing harm all over again. And there is where I'll leave off. You can read the entire article. It's posted on my website and progressradionetwork.com. Now, we're going to go to our guest in about 5 minutes, but before we do, I want to play you a clip from Bernie Sanders about 5 years ago, talking about why he opposed the Panama Treaty. It's only a short minute and a half clip, but was he absolutely prophetic? He was right. Hillary Clinton was wrong.
Let me say a word about the Panama Free Trade Agreement. Now, Panama is a very small country. Its entire annual economic output is only $26.7 billion a year, or about 0.2% of the American economy. So I think no one is going to legitimately stand up here and say that trading with such a small country is going to significantly increase American jobs. Then why would we? Why would we be considering a trade agreement with Panama? What's going on there? Well, it turns out, Mr. President, that Panama is a world leader when it comes to allowing wealthy Americans and large corporations to evade U.S. taxes by stashing their cash in offshore tax havens. And the Panama Free Trade Agreement would make this bad situation much worse. As I'm a member of the Budget Committee, as you are, Mr. President, and we have heard testimony time and time again that our country is losing up to $100 billion every year as corporations stash their money in postal addresses in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and in Panama. And this trade agreement makes that situation even worse. According to Citizens for Tax Justice, quote, "A tax haven has one of three characteristics. It has no income tax or a very low rate income tax. It has bank secrecy laws. And it has a history of non-cooperation with other countries on exchanging information about tax matters. Panama has all three of those, and they are probably the worst," end of quote, according to Citizens for Tax Justice. The trade agreement with Panama would effectively bar the United States from cracking down on illegal and abusive offshore tax havens in Panama. In fact, combating tax haven abuse in Panama would be a violation of this free trade agreement, exposing the U.S. to fines from international authorities. Well, at a time when we have a $14 trillion plus national debt, and at a time when we are frantically figuring out ways to try to lower our deficit, some of us believe that it is a good idea to do away with all of these tax havens by which the wealthy and large corporations stash their money abroad and avoid paying U.S. taxes. The Panama Trade Agreement would make that goal even more difficult.
Two thoughts. One is that over 400 journalists from around the world have had these documents for more than a year, and yet no one has leaked it. What does that tell you? That simply is not possible. Separately, they went after Putin, but it was not Putin that could be shown to have billions of dollars in any foreign account, and they went after people in other countries. Doesn't it surprise you that with all the billionaires, multimillionaires, major corporations in the United States, that not one has been mentioned? Do you think that's an accident? Do you think everyone in the world hides their money in offshore accounts, but no one in America who's politically connected do? We already know that $31 trillion has been stored in offshore accounts legally and some illegally. We also know that over $3 trillion in personal money is stored. The issue is, did they pay taxes on it? Now, maybe it's completely legal. Maybe it's not. So that's one thing that they have not mentioned. They have not brought up the Americans, corporations, individuals, the famous ones, who have been using these accounts. And yet we also had these journalists. I smell the National Security Agency all over this, because none of this could have happened if the National Security Agency did not know all of it, because every single transaction, every single electronic communication they are listening to, they're reading. And you're trying to tell me that when you have the largest single cache of secret documents in the world involving something as sensitive as this, that they didn't have meetings to discuss who should we target, who can we embarrass, but make sure that no Americans thus far. So where are the Americans, and why aren't the journalists talking about the Americans? So that's a red flag for me. Separately, how do you keep this from happening? And that's more importantly. If we simply had the common sense to have a flat corporate income tax, one tax, make it reasonable. Right now it's over 35%, but let's make it really reasonable. Every single business, from a single proprietorship to a $100 billion company like Google, make them pay a flat 15% tax. All right? That's very reasonable for everyone. But no more deductions, no more accounting. You throw out the IRS, you throw out the Federal Reserve, you let the Treasury do the printing of money at zero interest. You could bring in an extra $1.5 trillion in income a year that none of those major corporations are paying. And that way you have an income where no one has to hide it. You give an amnesty, they pay 20%, no criminal charges, and you bring back $31 trillion. Well, 20% is $6 trillion. So you got $6 trillion right off the bat. Then you charge an amnesty for those that have had personal money stored around the world. That's another $500 billion. Then you bring in $1.5 trillion in the first year, just additional money that you wouldn't have had otherwise. Gee whiz, you just got $8 trillion to work with. And then you forgive all the major debt that is interest, which you could do. After all, we forgave all the debt of the major banks. Then let the Treasury forgive the debt of the interest on those. And then suddenly we're back to having a proper program. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We're heard in almost every country of the world and all across the United States in different stations. You're listening to the number one progressive radio program in anywhere, and we thank you for doing that. I'm going to go to Israel in a second to have our in-depth discussion with our guests. I just want to mention that coming up, starting the second Saturday of June, and starting at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it'll be approximately 3 hours. And every other week, for over 3 months, I'll be conducting a health support group. And I'm only doing one this year. But in it, I'll be working with people who are diabetic, overweight, high blood pressure, depression, and most importantly, anti-aging, trying to slow down and reverse the aging process. Keep in mind, I was a senior research fellow in anti-aging research at the Institute of Applied Biology for 33 years. And that's my interest. Because if I can help people slow down the process of aging with lifestyle and behavior modification, then think of the illnesses that you're helping people not experience. And thinking of how much damage that has been done that they've told you can't reverse this, indeed, we can reverse aging. We can help people with dementia, Alzheimer's, and memory loss. We can help people who have, with their skin and their hair and their nails and their energy and fatigue and pain. So many things we can do. Now, orthodox medicine may not be able to do it, but that doesn't mean others are not. And we have the experience to do it. In fact, my last support group, the results were just published in a mainstream peer-reviewed journal because the results were rather phenomenal. If you want to join me, we are limited in size. It'll be on the Upper West Side. You'll call this number, and at some point in the next 2 weeks, you'll be called back. But call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, or, if that line's busy, 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. We're gonna have classes in cooking. I'm going to bring in experts on holistic and preventative dentistry. We're going to have exercise, detoxification, everything you could imagine to help you understand how to live a longer and healthier life and to overcome a lot of conditions through lifestyle and behavior. It's not medical. Let's now say hello to Anthony Lowenstein from Israel. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on. How are you?
Good. I just want to let people know that you are a documentarian, that you have written a column for The Guardian in the UK, you have written for The New York Times, The Nation, Haaretz in Israel, The Australian Foreign Policy, The Electronic Intifada, Tycoon, all these other publications. You've reported from Israel, Pakistan, Haiti, Papua New Guinea, and you've also written some very important books, including one on Israel and Zionism, The Political Right, Vulture Capitalism, and the Environment. And your documentary, A Different Kind of Jew, was a finalist for the UN Media Peace Award. And your most recent book is called Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe, which is also being made into a movie. And your website is AnthonyLowenstein.com. Anthony, I want to begin putting forth a kind of timeline that brings us to the topic of disaster capitalism as we witness it today with the collapse of the Soviet Union. The bipolar world divided by two superpowers came to an end. Globalization, free trade, neoliberal economics became forefront. And for a moment, there seemed to be a glimmer of hope for civil society to have a place at the table of governance. We saw this in the anti-globalization movement and civil society putting pressure on nations who embraced the free market dogma. Then 9/11 occurred. The war on terrorism replaced globalization concerns, and increasingly, as I'm sure you're more than aware, we are witnessing the power and influence of national governments and their political and economic policies waning and being usurped by private corporations and financial interests. And today, everything is being privatized, both in the United States and Europe and in Africa and throughout all developing nations. They're creating an indebtedness to the international banking regimes. But to accomplish this, they have to grab all the power they can from citizens and government legislative bodies and basically destroy democracy in the process. And I believe that you have focused on this in what is known as the Limits of Growth study back in the 1970s, where a person stated that it's profitable to let the world go to hell. So begin there and take your time to explain this more recent accelerated transition from democratic national government to political and economic rulership by corporate oligarchical elites. And what do you observe as the most salient, important events or instances that have most contributed to this transition? The forum is yours.
I think the way you describe that is really accurate. Very much what I look at in the book and a lot of my work. I became a professional journalist in a post-9/11 world. And obviously these issues didn't suddenly exist on the 12th of September 2001, but I think these trends have been massively accelerated. I think your timeline's pretty accurate. I look at this really going back to the 70s and 80s. Ronald Reagan, the President of the US, Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of the UK, both individuals, very powerful in their own time, very powerful in their own countries, had a belief which was shaped by a range of factors, a hatred of unions, a hatred of the left, a belief that the state's role should be reduced and corporations should be far more powerful under the guise of greater efficiency. So what began in those 34 years ago now was a growing reduction in state influence. That could be to do with immigration or prisons or war or aid or development in a range of different areas. And I think 9/11 accelerated that because, at least initially after those attacks, which of course were attacks against the US but were felt, as we all know, around the world in a range of ways, especially in the Western world and the Muslim world, that the effect has been, initially at least, far too few questions about the reality that the corporation, in my view and my research, has become more powerful than the state. And the effect of that in a place like, say, Afghanistan or Iraq, two countries the US, of course, has invaded and occupied, one in 2001, Afghanistan in October, and one in Iraq, March 2003, I don't argue, and my research does not say, that these countries are disaster zones now and failed states solely because private industry operates there or that private contractors have committed crimes or killed civilians. Not at all. But they've contributed to the instability in major, major ways, both in the countries themselves, in Iraq and Afghanistan, where, as an example, U.S. government reports in 2010, this is from the U.S. government report, found that the U.S. was paying contractors to transport goods from point A to point B, and the way that that contractor performed that task was paying off the Taliban to not shoot at those convoys. So in one very small way, you can see how U.S. taxpayer dollars are essentially paying the Taliban, a group that the U.S. government claims to be fighting in Afghanistan. That kind of crazy, mad irony is prevalent in these kind of situations. And I haven't been to Iraq, but I have been to Afghanistan twice in the last 4 years. And a lot of locals that I spoke to were directly affected by private security firms, both local and international. And what they routinely said was that the fact that local and foreign security would come into villages, attack people, kidnap people, kill people, under the guise of so-called protection, directly led to the huge surge in the insurgency. Now, the insurgency in Afghanistan and Iraq, as we know, has been incredibly deadly for the US, obviously Australia, Britain, pretty much every country that's in those nations. So that's one focus of my work. And another one, just briefly, is looking at the huge expansion in privatized immigration post 9/11. Immigration, of course, has been going on since humankind began. But what's particularly changed, as we've seen in the last 6-12 months in Europe, the massive movement of people, mostly from Africa and the Middle East, coming into Europe, the largest movement of people in many ways since the Second World War. And the effect of that has been in Britain, in Greece, in Germany, in Austria, and many other countries, a system that, one, can't handle the numbers of people who are coming, but secondly, governments are increasingly turning to private corporations to manage, so to speak, those issues. What I mean by that is private-sized detention centres or outsourcing food and health and those kind of basic services. And one of the things that I examined in my book is what that actually means in practice in places like the US, in places like the UK and Greece and Australia. All four separate countries. I'm not arguing that Greece, for example, is the same as Australia. They're not. But the similarity often is that the same companies are involved, the same abuses you see time and time again. So migrants being abused, bad healthcare, poor quality food, people sometimes being sexually assaulted. That's more women than men, but men sometimes being assaulted as well. A range of issues that are exacerbated by the outsourcing of these tasks because there's little or no accountability. Governments have little or no interest in bringing accountability. there's not massive amounts of public interest, sadly, to bring accountability. And, of course, it's a huge money spinner for the private corporation. So when, say, in the last 5 or 10 years, there's been a large number of immigrants crossing the U.S.-Mexican border from mostly Latin and South America, fleeing wars that the U.S. clearly has a direct hand in, whether it's drug wars or other kinds of wars, many of those immigrants end up in privatized detention centers, run for profit, with very, very bad conditions. And I spent time on some of those researching a few years ago in Georgia, and one of the largest centers in the country is in a small town called Lumpkin, about 3 hours from Atlanta. It's run by CCA, which is America's largest private prison corporation. And the conditions in these places is bad. And the effect of that is that the individuals who are based there, not for large amounts of time, sometimes 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, sometimes longer, are often given incredibly bad care. There's a lot of examples, both in that facility and elsewhere, people being abused, people dying, in fact, in those centres from bad and mismanagement. So all these issues in my work is to say that in the Western world, at least, almost by stealth, but also to some extent by public acceptance, there hasn't been massive public opposition, although, as you rightly said in your introduction, the anti-globalization movement around Seattle in the late 90s was definitely a movement against it. The Occupy movement in 2010-11 was definitely a movement against it. I would say some of the comments and positions that Bernie Sanders in the US is making, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the UK Labour Party, is also making, is definitely around these kinds of issues, that we're sold the lie that globalization, free trade brings greater freedom and greater economic rights, which actually, weirdly enough, Donald Trump has been saying in some ways too, although from a very different perspective, I might add. And it's a lie, because the economic situation of many individuals in Western countries, let alone in the developing world, is actually declining, not increasing. And that's the sad reality we face at the moment.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. I want to be very specific now, as just one example that could tell the whole much of the story of exploiting people's suffering, and that is the case of Haiti. And there are many Haitians listening to this program right now. You spent time in Haiti investigating how disaster capitalism has been executed there and how it has enslaved Haitian workers and even operates behind Haitian and international laws. And personally, when I think of Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake and how foreign corporate jackals ravaged the nation, I think of the Clintons. How is Haiti a clear example of disaster capitalism at work? And please place attention on the roles of Hillary and Bill Clinton, Hillary with his foundation, or Bill with his foundation, and Hillary as then Secretary of State, and how they both benefited financially or rewarded by their intervention there.
Haitians listening, of course, will know this, but for listeners who don't, just a very brief background. So there was an earthquake in January 2010, which mostly hit around Port-au-Prince, which is the capital. No one knows the exact death toll, which is a tragedy in itself, but it's estimated to be roughly 200,000 to 300,000 people. I visited Haiti in 2012 and in 2014, both for the book and the film, as I said, which I hope will be finished this year. And one of the things that became very clear speaking to a range of Haitians, both in Port-au-Prince but also in various other parts of the country, is that the earthquake merely exacerbated the economic crisis that the country already faced. The country was hardly in good shape before the earthquake hit, far from it. Not that long, in fact, after the earthquake, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she engineered almost a quasi-coup in that country. There was an election. There was an unconvincing consensus of who actually had won. A candidate who wasn't particularly successful, Michelle Martelly, was put forward by the Clintons, and I'm talking particularly about Hillary now, as the preferred president. And he basically ruled the country until a few months ago. I'll get back to that in a minute. So many Haitians that I spoke to said that our country has been occupied in many ways for a century. The U.S. has had massive involvement there, economically, politically, militarily. The U.S. has backed countless dictatorships in that country. And so there's an issue of military dictatorship and all that brings with it, autocracy, torture, death squads. That's one horrific side which has existed for decades. The other side is economic slavery, as you rightly say. And the U.S., its successive administration, Democrat and Republican. In fact, in some ways, as you say, it was maybe worse under the Democrat, Bill Clinton, in the 90s, is that Haiti was seen and sold as a place to produce cheap clothing and cheap goods for American consumers, but also for others. So, for example, there are clothes made there for The Gap, for Walmart, many other clothing labels that are obviously available in the US, but also many countries around the world. The involvement of the Clintons is quite central, both when Bill was president, but also when Hillary was Secretary of State, in two ways, and I'll briefly explain. One, when Bill was president in the 90s, he put in place a number of trade policies that massively disadvantaged Haitian farmers. The effect of that was that Haitian farmers were able to produce a range of goods for their own communities, but routinely they weren't able to sell those goods because American farmers got precedence. In other words, the earthquake happened in 2010, long after, of course, Bill Clinton left office. But the effect of that was that huge amounts of food was brought into the country from the US. When Haitian farmers themselves were saying, both to me and to a range of other people, we're able to support our own communities, we're able to provide enough food. The country needed huge support after the earthquake. I'm not suggesting they did not. Particularly in the area of food, Haiti was fine. Haiti was able to provide for itself. But because of trade deals put in place by Bill Clinton in the 90s, that was a massive impediment to that happening. Fast forward to 2010. The earthquake happened. It was a devastation strike. The range of international NGOs, American corporations, the US government come in providing huge amounts of support. And some of that support was undeniably needed and required. Water, sanitation. Although I should add on that point, for those who don't know, the United Nations, which has been militarily occupying that country for years, after the earthquake, Nepalese troops came to support the UN peacekeepers, so-called peacekeepers in Haiti. Nepalese peacekeepers brought cholera, a disease that had not been seen in Haiti for over a century. The effect of that now, 6 years on, is roughly 10,000 Haitians who have died from cholera, close to a million who have been affected by the disease, and the UN refuses to this day, despite a range of legal cases trying to prosecute them both in Haitian courts and US courts, refuses to take responsibility for helping the mess, for cleaning up the mess, for putting in place better sanitation. So Haiti has been hit time and time again. The Clinton Foundation, moving on to that, has been deeply complicit in a range of ways, briefly. One, they have implemented a range of economic policies that support the idea that industrial park, so-called, is a solution to Haiti's problems. In other words, building factories in remote parts of the country where locals can work and earn very, very poor wages to make clothes and goods for American consumers. After the earthquake hit, Hillary Clinton, amongst others, signs a deal with a South Korean clothing company called Saya in the north of the country, Caracol, and I visited there in 2012. And these facilities are not sweatshops, as we would imagine in parts of Asia. They're not that bad. However, conditions are poor. Housing nearby is in shoddy condition. The money is $4 to $5 US a day, which is A, below the minimum wage, and B, workers who are there having to spend some of that tiny amounts of money on transport and food. So the Clinton Foundation both supports these policies, both before the earthquake and after them, and Hillary, as Secretary of State, pushes those policies in place, claiming that this is going to bring huge amounts of job opportunities for Haitian people. The fact is, 6 years on, the numbers of people who are working in these facilities is incredibly slim. She predicted 70,000, give or take, workers would be working there within a number of years. There are now less than 10,000. No one knows the exact number, but less than 10,000. So what really, I guess, frustrates me about this question is that time and time and time again, Haiti is not asked what they want. The Haitian people have little or no independence. In fact, what Haitians said to me over and over and over again is, we're an occupied country. We're occupied by the UN. We're occupied by the US. We're occupied by USAID, which is the US aid arm. In other words, I'm not suggesting that no US aid programs have helped. Some of them definitely have. But so much of what came out of the Hillary Clinton State Department post-2010 earthquake has been disastrous. And in fact, the metrics on the Haitian economy speaks for itself. Things are very, very dire. Listeners will be aware that even this year, the Haitian parliament is dysfunctional and barely has an operating government. I mean, that's putting it mildly. And one last quick point. After the US has spent roughly up to anywhere between $7 to $10 billion, only 2% of that money has stayed in Haiti. In other words, the vast majority of that money has gone to either US corporations or US NGOs. Now, I'm not saying that none of those organizations have done any good work, but the key problem with the delivery of aid in Haiti has been that Haitians have not been empowered. Haitians have not been trained in general. So when those NGOs or those corporations leave, which they inevitably do and move on to the next disaster or crisis, Haitians themselves have very few learnt and educated skills that they would have learnt from those partners to move forward, and which is why unemployment in Haiti is so high and political dysfunction remains, and it's why Haiti is the poorest country in its hemisphere. It's a very grim situation, and the Clintons have a lot to answer for, and I wish during this election cycle in your country, the US, that Hillary was actually asked serious questions about her record there, because just for listeners who don't know, Hillary and Bill had their honeymoon in Haiti many, many, many years ago. And they've often talked about their love and admiration and respect for the Haitian people. But when they've been in power, the reality has been something very different.
Anthony, thank you very much for giving us this in-depth explanation. My hope is that your film will be widely viewed. It is needed. And the book, Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe, is read. The website is AnthonyLowenstein.com. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.